Well, about 8 years ago, I had the very good fortune that Christian Solari, who was a PhD student with Rick Michaud at the University of Arizona, where I was at the time, walked across the street to the physics department and knocked on the doors of John Kessler and myself, asking questions about the possible role of fluid mechanics in these wonderful organisms we've heard so much about, the volvocene green algae. I knew absolutely nothing about them at the time, but I found these very, very compelling questions. And in fact, much of the research that I now do is basically trying to understand physical aspects of the evolutionary transitions to multicellularity. But for those of you not familiar with Cambridge, I should say one thing important, which is that rule number one is that the name of departments and what goes on inside have almost nothing to do with each other. And so although this is a theoretical physics department, it's home to a cell biology lab where we study these problems in considerable detail. Now, one of the things I found most compelling about this question of the evolution of multicellularity is illustrated in this beautiful set of data that was first presented by Bell and Moores and was referred to by Roberta Fischer in her talk, a graph of the total number of distinct cell types in organisms whose total number of cells are shown in the x-axis. And I like this graph for two reasons. One is that the physicists in the audience usually react by trying to find a power law that describes the general trend increasing from lower left to upper right. And that's not what you should do. But also, it's such noisy data that what would one exponent mean out of that? But more importantly, I think it points out that we should really focus our attention, I think, at the lower left-hand corner of this graph, where we go from the simplicity of a bacterium that has one cell and does all the functions of life with that one cell, to ever larger organisms, which at some point transition to having, say, two cell types. And in fact, Rick Grossberg the other day mentioned that not so much perhaps worrying about where this transition to complexity occurs, but how do the organisms along the way there with ever larger cell number but identical cell types actually function? And so I decided that in my talk today I should try to give you a sort of case study or several case studies of how through physics and fluid mechanics and biology we can try to answer some questions about how these organisms function. I'm not going to provide an answer to the question of the origin of multicellularity, but maybe give you a flavor for how we in the physics community think about these problems. Now, we've seen many pictures of the volvocene algae, and you know, a person who just walked into the room from another discipline might have thought that they just sit there, but they don't. I mean, just go back to van Leeuwenhoek's letter to the Royal Society in 1700, and the thing that was a most pleasant sight was their persistent rolling motion that comes about from all the flagella on the surface of these organisms. And in fact, the very name Volvox was given to it by Linnaeus because of its persistent rolling motion. Think of the Latin root for the car, Volvo, right? This is an organism that moves around in its fluid environment. And one of the most basic aspects of life is exchanging material with the environment. And that's a problem in diffusion and perhaps mixing, all driven by flagella and locomotion. So my fixation on these problems has been to try to understand the basic fluid mechanics of how these organisms function, and then to use that to help inform possible scenarios about the evolution of multicellularity. So there are many things that we have learned from these organisms, and I think it's fair to say that these green algae spanning the range from Chlamydomonas to Volvox and actually extending to aquatic plants like Cara and others are turning out to be model organisms, not only in evolutionary biology, but also for biological fluid mechanics and biological physics. So there are all sorts of issues you can ask besides the obvious one of how we develop multicellularity, things like the synchronization of the flagella that these organisms have, or interesting kinds of interactions between pairs of them, the fluid mechanical flow fields around them, how they steer through their environment toward the sun, what you know, the physics and fluid mechanics of cytoplasmic streaming inside large eukaryotic cells, etc. So I'm going to focus on a couple of these as case studies. And the first thing I want to say is that we've heard a lot about the biology underlying, say, transitions to multicellularity, but I want to talk about some of the physical aspects that could play a role. Now, all of these organisms that I'm discussing swim through their fluid environment. They swim at some speed u, which could be 100 or 500 microns per second. They live in a fluid environment with a certain viscosity, and we have to know what's important and what's not important. So the first thing to say is that you're all familiar with the concept of the Reynolds number. Probably you've heard it, which is this dimensionless number that explains to us whether it's important that there's inertia in a system or not. So if I'm in a swimming pool and I push off one side, I can coast to the other side because viscosity is so unimportant on the scale that I am. But these organisms live in an environment where viscosity dominates because they're so small. And the characteristic dimensionless number, the Reynolds number, is the product of a typical swimming speed, a typical size, divided by the kinematic viscosity of water, which in conventional units would be something like 10 to the minus 2. And so for an organism like Chlamydomonas or Volvox, this Reynolds number turns out to be something like 10 to the minus 3 or 4, which means that basically if it stops moving its appendages, it stops moving immediately, unlike us. But there's another number that's important, which has to do with things like nutrient uptake or waste disposal, which is some chemical species that's moving around in the environment, which has a diffusion constant, D. And the thing to do is to calculate two different time scales associated with the transport of that molecular species. One would be that if I have a length L and I am pushing fluid around at velocity U, I can just carry the stuff and the time it takes will be L over U. On the other hand, if I have a diffusion constant D, the time will go like L squared over D. And so if I take the ratio of those two, I get what's known as the Peclet number. And it's UL over D just like UL over nu. But the diffusion constant of small molecules is three orders of magnitude smaller than the viscosity of water, which means this Peclet number is already three orders of magnitude larger. Therefore, if I look at an organism like Chlamydomonas, which is 10 microns across, swims at 50 or 100 microns per second with a typical small molecule, its Peclet number is 1 or less. So it's in a regime where diffusion dominates, but just barely. There's a kind of match between the two. But by the time I get to an organism like Volvox that has thousands of flagella on its surface, is 50 times larger, and can swim 5 times faster or more, its Peclet number is 250 or something like that, which means that the transport of fluid is 250 times more important than the diffusion of these small molecules. And this has been suggested, it's a hypothesis, as one of the many interesting possible reasons for the transition to multiple cell types. But this organism lives in a world fundamentally dominated by diffusion. This lives in a world fundamentally dominated by advection. So I just wanted to read that into the record to show you that we have to start putting numbers in to decide what's important and what's not important. Now, another view of Volvox is this. This is a video that was taken in my lab in which we have a tracking microscope that is looking at Volvox on a moving stage. So with feedback, it follows it as it swims up against gravity. And with a laser sheet coming down and microspheres in the solution, you can actually track out the flow field around this organism with high precision and ask a question like, how do I relate the 1,000 flagella's motion on the surface of this colony to the large-scale fluid flow that I see? And because this can be done with great precision, and we can do a technique called particle image velocimetry to track these the motion of these microspheres over, say, 50,000 frames with great steadiness, we can get very, very high resolution streamlines and flow fields around these organisms and try to think about how they swim and what kind of disturbance they make in their environment. So the technology that I want to tell you about that we've used to study some aspects of this involves a combination of those kinds of experiments, but also just conventional, in some ways, conventional imaging on inverted microscopes with a lot of high-speed imaging technology so that we can follow the flagellar dynamics of these organisms with great accuracy and understand what's going on. And we also borrow some technology from the world of in vitro fertilization or electrophysiology to use micropipettes to hold them gently so that we can study exactly what's going on. And the first problem that I want to talk about is one which we've studied through a combination of these two methods in which we can hold a Volvox and actually study its response to light to try to understand a very basic question in the world of phototaxis. But the thing I want to emphasize about these organisms that makes them so interesting from the point of view of biological fluid mechanics is seen in their life cycle. So if we take the typical 48-hour life cycle of Volvox carteri, the workhorse organism, the thing to realize is that once the colonies are hatched out of the mother and all the interesting development is going on the inside as far as the formation of the daughter colonies, the outside has a fixed cell number, a fixed number of somatic cells. As the extracellular matrix is added, all that's happening is this thing is inflating slowly over the course of 2 days. So that makes the flagella move apart slowly, makes the density offset with respect to water change slowly. It makes all the fundamental properties of the system change slowly over time, and we can do experiments all along there and use time or radius as a parameter to see what's going on. And that's, I think, a very wonderful thing that nature has handed us to uncover the physics and fluid mechanics of how they swim. So, for instance, you can track over the course of time or radius, things like the speed with which the organisms swim up against gravity. So the young guys are very fast, and the old guys, as they get older, eventually reach a point where they can't stay up anymore, and they hover and then sink. You can look at the speed at which they settle if you deflagellate them with a pH shock, and that's a smooth function of radius, and from that you can infer the density difference they have with respect to water. Most importantly, Volvox was given its name because it spins. And that spinning frequency is a very strong function of size, changing by more than an order of magnitude as they get old. And that I'll come back to. And there's another interesting time scale of the problem, which is the following. Volvox is bottom heavy, I like to say, as many of us. Its daughter colonies are in the posterior. So if you tilt the colony axis with respect to vertical, there's a viscous relaxation time for them to come back straight. And that time scale turns out to be noisy, but basically pretty much independent of radius. And it's about 10 seconds. And that's an interesting time to think about. They're rigidly attached on the inside, yeah. Okay, so I'm going to try to give you just a little story first about how we've come to understand how these organisms can execute accurate phototaxis. So if their colonial axis is not facing the sun, and I turn the sun on and let it move, they will accurately turn and go toward the light. And they need to because they're photosynthetic. But look, they have no central nervous system. There are 1,000 independent players on the surface of this sphere, and yet they manage to do this. And it's an incredibly interesting and simple question. How do they do it? So if they have no central nervous system, and if there really is no discussion among the cells, the only answer can be that everybody is endowed with the right program of response to the light to make it happen. And it just looks like coherent, organized, collective behavior, but it's just like I gave each of you a prayer book, and you know, you in unison said the right thing. So what would that program be? Okay, so the first thing you have to know, if you don't know already, is that every cell, every somatic cell has an eye spot. And if we look at the anterior north pole of the colony and look around, you'll see that there is a very highly organized pattern to the arrangement of these eye spots. And in fact, if you take a colony and smush it against a glass slide, and then identify each eye spot and draw an arrow from the center of the somatic cell to the eye spot, you, especially for the physicists in the audience, will see this kind of order of these arrows. It looks like a magnetic system. It's known as planar cell polarity. And it's pretty highly organized. So all the cells are looking pretty much out and down. And these eye spots have the feature that they're sensitive to light only in the forward hemisphere. So they don't see light behind them. That means that as they're moving around, only when they're facing the light, in a sense, do they see it. OK, so an equation or two just to show you what we're up against. We'd like to try to understand the rate at which a sphere in a fluid rotates in response to external forces and internal driving. So the first thing is the angular velocity of a sphere can be written in this case as one piece relying on the bottom heaviness time scale. It's the cross product of the direction of gravity and the axis direction. So if they're parallel, there's no motion. But if they're not parallel, there's a relaxation on that time scale. Now, there's another way of looking at this problem, which is what happens if there's a fluid flow over the surface of the sphere? What does that do to its turning? Now, you can take the point of view that I'm going to try to solve for the equations of the 1,000 flagella on the surface, but do not do that. Instead, I think the appropriate point of view is to say, on some coarse-grained average level, there is a velocity field on the surface given by the flagella. And if we knew that, Stone and Samuels' brilliant rewriting of a theorem in fluid mechanics tells us we just integrate that velocity around the surface, crossing it with the surface normal. Okay, so if I knew the fluid velocity, I could predict what happens. And what you can see from this is if the velocity were everywhere constant on the surface, this integral would be zero by symmetry. So obviously, it's not going to turn if everything's doing the same thing. So it's only by an asymmetry in that velocity that we can get a turning. And we're going to try to figure out a way of explaining that. And if I sit in the frame of reference of the Volvox, the direction in which light is coming just evolves according to what we would call solid body rotation. So this is a closed system if I know you. OK, so how are we going to measure this? We're going to use micropipette technology to hold an individual Volvox colony here. We're going to bring an optical fiber up close to it and shine light, which we can turn on and off at an adjustable frequency to mimic the fact that a piece of real estate on the surface rotating around will come in and out of the light at a frequency equal to the rotation frequency. But we can adjust the frequency of that on and off to be whatever we want to understand the dynamics. So the ordinary colony is spinning around an axis, creating fluid flow this way. So the theory and experiments that I'll describe to you were done just a few months before a competing group did essentially the same thing, and we both agreed on the answer. OK, So here's a little video just to show you what's going on. We have a Volvox colony held. We're looking at a high-speed camera. With a high-speed camera, but actually this is not particularly high speed. The light is off. You see the microsphere is getting advected. The colonial axis is this way. And as soon as the light goes on, there's a slowdown in the velocity. It's very hard to see at first, but there's a slowdown in the velocity, and then it recovers, and it's back to where it was before. So that's a very interesting response, and you can quantify it in the following way. This is the fluid flow speed near some patch on the surface as a function of time in seconds. At the point where I turn off, I go from the light being off to light being on, there's a very fast downregulation of the beating on a sort of 50 millisecond time scale, and then a slow recovery of that beating over the course of many seconds. So there are two time scales in the problem. Now you might look at this and think, ooh, this is some kind of excitable medium with some complicated dynamics going on, but actually you can characterize this by the two coupled linear equations. If you think that there's an observable response I'll call P, the photo response, there's a signal S, and there's some hidden H, internal relaxation variable, that I do not understand at this point biochemically, but I think exists, which relaxes on another time scale. So basically, H is trying to relax to the signal with a time scale tau sub A, and P is relaxing to the difference between those two on a time scale tau response. And these two together give this kind of capacitor charging and then discharging response that you see here. Two time scales, linear equations. Sure. You have to look carefully. Yeah? Held fixed in a lab frame. Right, and I'll show you a graph in a moment that will help explain what's going on. If you now look across the entire colony's surface as a function of polar angle from the North Pole down, you'll find that if, in black, you have the initial velocity profile, slightly asymmetric, that as soon as you turn on the light, you get down-regulation of the beating. It is very strong in the northern hemisphere, but basically non-existent in the southern hemisphere. The guys in the back, I always call the galley slaves who just keep swimming, but the ones in the front have this adaptive response. Okay, and so it exists everywhere. So the point of view we're going to take is that we can map out the flow field that existed before anything happened with the light, and whatever it was, it's multiplied by a small correction factor associated with this time-dependent response everywhere. And you could make models of varying complexity if you incorporate all this angular dependence or not. Okay, so now we do the following experiment. We turn the light on and off at an adjustable frequency, and we look at the depth of this photoresponse, the maximum depth of downregulation of the beating, and normalize it appropriately. And what you find is that at very low frequencies of turning the light on and off, you get very little response. At very high frequencies, you get very little response. There are two timescales in the system. It means there are two characteristic frequencies in the system. And in the middle, you get a big peak of response, maximum depth of photoresponse. Okay, and in fact, mathematically, you can write down a form from those two differential equations that pretty much captures exactly what we see. So what does this mean? It turns out that this band of frequencies frequencies of turning the light on and off corresponds actually to the orbital frequency of the colonies that are good at phototaxis. And so there appears to be a tuning between this adaptive time scale and the orbital motion of the colony. And this allows us to ask the question, which I think has been sitting unanswered since von Leeuwenhoek, which is, why does Volvox turn? And it turns, maybe there's a chicken and egg issue here, but it turns so that it can phototax. Because if the time scale of response is such that it takes about half an orbital period to recover your beating after you move into the light, the net effect will be that the bright side beats slower than the dark side. And you have that asymmetry, and you will turn. Okay. Well, it will change over time, so you have to make it a whole dynamical system. But suppose that it is. Then it will start out with the asymmetry that will make it turn, and then we'll see what happens.
And your elegant experiment with high tech suppresses the actual rotation?
It suppresses the actual rotation, but then we do an experiment that doesn't. Okay. So here it turns out the early guys, the young guys who were just born, the juveniles, are very good at phototaxis, and there's the range of orbital of sizes over which they're very good at phototaxis. Okay, so you can put this all together. I'm going to skip all the mathematical details, but you take a sphere computationally, you endow the surface of it with these two variables, And you follow the rule of low Reynolds number fluid mechanics, which I outlined to you. And you can start with the light here and the colonial axis there and see what happens. And we'll let blue represent regular beating, normal beating in the dark, and red represent down regulation regions. And what you find is there's the asymmetry. It starts turning. But the more it starts turning, the more it's constantly bathed in light and not subjected to this on and off. And so it recovers completely with a fixed point here, and everybody's happy. So this shows something I think very important on this path toward multicellularity, that if we ask the question about how do they function when they're sticking together, the answer is they don't have to talk to each other, which is probably good if you're just starting out on that path, if they just have the right program. Now, this is actually a version of what Chlamydomonas does. Chlamydomonas has only two flagella and one eye spot, but its two flagella respond differently to the internal calcium that's spewed out when the photoreceptor experiences changing light levels, and that allows it to turn. But this has two very different time scales, adaptation and response. Chlamydomonas does not. So there's an interesting question. Maybe the next time we meet, I'll be able to tell you the answer. How do these time scales evolve in size as I go from Chlamydomonas all the way up to Volvox? Is this mechanism actually working in the intermediate species? We don't know yet. So the flagellar directions are absolutely hardwired in a sense. They beat north pole to south pole with a slight east-west twist, and all that happens is the sort of frequency or strength of beating changes. Okay. Now you can make a test of this, and this is, you know, the physicists in the audience have been asking about how do we test something. This is one way to test something. You look at an assay for phototactic ability in free fluid without holding it on the micropipette, and you normalize it to one for the guys who are rotating at the normal frequency, and then you add something to the fluid that makes the viscosity larger. And that slows down the rotation, but their adaptation response is unchanged. And so you frustrate their ability to phototax because you just made their rotation frequency too low. And sure enough, the phototactic ability dies away completely, and it's consistent with the predictions of that simple model. So this is, you know, giving us some feeling that we sort of understand what's going on, and now we know what to do next, which is to see whether this holds for the other kinds of organisms. Okay, so I'm going to now turn to a sort of second example. This one probably doesn't have much to do with multicellularity, but it gets to the question of how organisms interact with each other and how the flow fields around them dictate those interactions. We've been interested and have recently measured the flow fields around E. coli and around Chlamydomonas and around Volvox with great precision. But some years ago, we thought, let's just throw a bunch of Volvox together into a box and see what they do, because we imagined that the flow field should make them interact in interesting ways. So this is a microscope slide sandwich with about a millimeter of, or 2 millimeters of fluid between them and just a pile of Volvox whizzing around. And if you look right here, you'll see an example of two that seem to be intimate with each other. And so this led us to look very closely at what's going on. Now, in order to do this experiment properly, one has to worry about the fact that the very act of illuminating this thing with light can trigger a photo response. So you have to use red light far enough to the red. But secondly, you could actually heat up the system by shining light on it, and that can produce convective currents that mess up everything. So we built this apparatus, which is basically an inner chamber on the centimeter scale, an outer heat bath, red light, and a dual view imaging system so we could map out what's going on in stereoscopic mode. And with that, we found the existence of this wonderful thing, which has been dubbed the waltzing Volvox. So we're looking down through the glass top at organisms that have swum up to this glass ceiling and are spinning around. Now, look what happened. That one got pushed away, and now it comes back. So first of all, you might think this is some kind of chemotactic signaling and they're coming next to each other, but it's not. It's purely driven by fluid mechanics, and I can show you that that's true. It's not the way you'd build normal gears. The teeth would be worn off very quickly. But it's a really interesting fluid mechanical attraction between objects that calls out for an explanation. And it's nice to be here in UCSB because actually Todd Squires, who's a professor over in engineering, wrote the crucial paper that gave me the idea to figure out what's going on here. So if you actually image this in a time series, you see this beautiful orbiting. If you look from the top at tracer particle trajectories, you find that they're getting sucked into the colony and then pushed down. And if you look from the side, you see these two beautiful vortices. They're actually, it's really a cut through a toroidal vortex that's going around as this organism bumps up against the ceiling. So what's going on? Okay, so a little bit more math. It turns out when you think about these organisms, again, you could imagine trying to deal with all of their complexity in terms of thousands of flagella, et cetera, but the point of view of look from a distance, it's just a sphere. It has forces acting on it. It can swim. It has gravity acting on it because we know it has a density offset. So let's just describe its dynamics as a point particle. And there are two things you would say. One is that the velocity, dx dt, of its position would be the fluid velocity at its location, maybe due to the other one, plus its natural swimming speed, if it had one. And then there's a second variable, which is the axis orientation, which evolves, as I showed you before. So the angular velocity is this cross product with the direction of gravity. And then if the fluid has what's called vorticity, which is swirl, that will tend to rotate it as well. Now, Blake, in Cambridge in his PhD thesis, wrote an incredibly famous and beautiful paper on what happens when you have what is called a Stokeslet. That's the essentially the fluid solution to a point force acting on a fluid near a wall, a no-slip wall. And this was used by Squires to predict that there should be attractive interaction for spheres that are somehow hovering near an upper wall. So if gravity points away from the wall and the wall is above, he predicted there would be an attractive interaction between Stokeslets. So if you take the analysis in his paper and rewrite these equations of motion for the lateral positions evolution in time, where x is a rescaled position in units of the distance away, and time is scaled with the gravitational force and the viscosity of the fluid, et cetera, you get this beautiful dimensionless closed form universal equation for how they should fall into each other. No parameters. And so you do a lot of experiments on this, and it works. Right? So time is negative here, so the time before touching. And it just fits. Right? So that makes us feel good, right? Because we can say there's a simplification here. Just a few things matter, the density offset, the presence of this no-slip wall. And you can even, with a little more hydrodynamics, actually predict the rotation frequency around the two colonies. OK, so that's kind of neat. And then you can do sophisticated numerical computations. This was done by Takuji Ishikawa, who's a longstanding collaborator of Tim Pedley's in Cambridge, who's extremely good at these complicated calculations where you have real spheres and real walls, and you do the whole problem. So here it is viewed from the side. Here it is viewed from above. They're spinning. There's a cutoff so they don't touch, and they beautifully rotate around each other. So there's the simple model of point particles, and there's the more sophisticated model of real spheres, et cetera. Now, actually, if you choose the colonies that are not young and swim up and get stuck at the surface, but you choose the ones that hover, they're just barely staying up against gravity, then, as my brilliant student Knut Drescher discovered late one night, you get not waltzing, but the minuet. So here's the chamber bottom, and these guys are just doing that. Right? And this was really weird for us because, you know, it looks like there's an elastic spring between them, but there isn't. And it's an oscillation at low Reynolds number, which is also puzzling. But again, you make a simple model. You basically assume that they hover. They produce a Stokeslet. But when they tilt with respect to vertical, they're no longer swimming up. So there's a slight tendency to sink. You have to build that in. And you just evolve the axis as before. And if you make a model of that, not with the surface, but just hovering, those two-point particles execute exactly the motion that we were talking about. And then you can work out things like the oscillation amplitude as a function of the bottom heaviness relaxation time, and you discover that there's a transition from steady motion to this periodic motion along the way. So that's kind of amusing. Now I'm just about out of time, and maybe I can squeeze in with the 2 minutes a little discussion that gets back to this question about the origin of multicellularity. And this is a simple model that we published some years ago, where we just tried to understand how the business of being at high Peclet number, meaning fluid flow dominates over diffusion, might affect things like nutrient uptake. It's a super simple model. You can criticize it a lot, but it's a way of thinking about things. So if I'm a Volvox and I don't swim and I'm just a sphere absorbing things by diffusion, then it's well known, probably to most of you in the audience, that if the steady state concentration field around that absorber would be whatever it is at infinity, with this correction where R is my distance from the sphere and capital R is the radius of the sphere. So it vanishes out of the sphere if it's a perfect absorber. And if you calculate the current of nutrients going into the sphere, it's proportional to the radius, not r squared, because, yes, you integrate over the surface, but the gradient on the surface for Fick's law falls off like 1 over r. So if I plot the current as a function of size, imagining a sequence of organisms made out of the same building blocks, Chlamydomonas, like somatic cells, but ever larger, that would be linear. But if you're built like Volvox and all your tissue is on the surface, never mind the germ cells on the inside, let's think about it beforehand, clearly my needs, my nutrient needs, must scale with the surface area, because that counts how many cells there are. So obviously this crosses somewhere, and this is a well-known crossing point. Now, we try to estimate where this crossing point is, and it's extremely hard because the data in the literature is not good enough. But it turns out to be vaguely near the length scale at which germ soma differentiation sets in these organisms. And we know there are Volvox that exist that are much larger, so the conclusion is Volvox cannot live by diffusion alone. Right? Something has to help it. And well, it's got all this fluid flow. So how are we to calculate what the fluid flow does to the flux of nutrients? And here's another simple model. Skip 1,000 flagella. Just endow the surface of the sphere with a vector of forces uniformly over the sphere pointing in the direction that you see. And this is something I worked out with Martin Short, not the comedian, but my former PhD student. And it's a nice exercise in special functions. But the most important thing is that if this force per unit area has magnitude F, you get a prediction that the characteristic swimming speed should scale with F, actually increase with the radius, and be inversely proportional to the viscosity. So the larger guys swim faster. OK, and here's one of our earlier measurements of the fluid flow around the colony. And it pretty much matches this kind of theory. OK, so now there's a long song and dance about what does this do to nutrient uptake. And there's a question that goes back actually many, many decades, which is, if I have a hot sphere in a wind, how does the wind increase the heat loss from it? And this is pretty much the same kind of problem, except that the boundary conditions are different. It's not a solid sphere. It's got a tangential velocity. And just at the same time we were doing this, Tim Pedley also worked out that the current would be proportional to the radius, but augmented by a factor of the square root of the Peclet number, which comes from the formation of a boundary layer on the surface. OK, so I'll skip the math of that. But if the Peclet number is a velocity times r over d, it therefore goes like r squared. And it's dimensionless, so there must be a new length in the problem. If you put in all the numbers, you discover there's a new length that's about 10 microns, which is about the size of the flagella. So now we have a bottleneck size, and we have a flagellar boundary layer size. And you can ask, how does the current vary with size? And here it is on a log-log scale. So here's the current in units of the diffusive contribution as a function of the radius measured by that advective radius. And it turns out, OK, the diffusive part is proportional to r to the 1, so it's a straight line of slope 1. The metabolic needs are proportional to r squared with a slope 2. They cross at this crossing point. And the real advective combination contribution peels off early and then rises like r squared, which is just what you need. So apparently, you can bypass the bottleneck by having this flow. And if you calculate the difference between these two, that's the extra nutrient uptake you get from having flow. And that, per unit area, as a function of size, rapidly increases from the scale of about Chlamydomonas up to, say, Volvox, and then levels off. So this provides a hypothesis that socialism is at work here. Everybody beats together, and they collectively enhance the nutrient uptake in a way that is strongly dependent on size. This could help understand why it is that germ soma differentiation. So we could, in principle, try to check this. Yeah, although life is never so simple that we wouldn't change other things. OK, so look, that's the end of my time. I just want you to realize that this is the work of a lot of people over a lot of years, in particular my dedicated postdocs, Marco Polini, Don Tuval, Kyriakos Leptos, Vasily Kanzler, more recently with Jorn Dunkel. And in collaboration with Christian Solari, it was Sujoy Ganguly, then an undergraduate at Arizona, who really got us started. I set him the challenge of producing Volvox on a stick so we could measure everything, and he did it. And he was followed up by Sujoy version 2, namely Knut Drescher, who has done most of the work I described to you on phototaxis, et cetera. Thank you. waiting for the but.
So it's very nice work. So the interesting thing that I'm reading into what you've been coming up with over the last several years, there's been this idea of these cytoplasmic bridges between cells.
Oh, yes.
And so I think your data might suggest that those are not for signaling, they may be for patterning, to get the proper patterning of cells so that you can get these motions.
Okay.
What would your thoughts on that be?
Okay, so there's this long story really about, well, there are two long stories. One is there are two types of volvox, those that have cytoplasmic bridges to the adult and those that don't. And basically going back to the paper of Hyatt and Hand, I think it was, that there's not much difference apparently in their behavior. But of course, it's the breakage of those cytoplasmic bridges after inversion where things start developing an ECM, et cetera. So this whole question of how the cells maintain their orientation and all of that, I think, is templated perhaps by the bridges up to the point of inversion. But then after that, it's not clear how it's maintained. And that's one of the things we're actually looking at. One of Holman's postdocs has just joined my group, and we're going to try to figure that out.
So have you tried an experiment? Oh, sorry. So in the phototaxis experiment, have you tried to maybe turn down the intensity to see how many photons at a minimum the volvox needs to be coherently?
We haven't tried that. We did systematically look at the intensity because it switches, the phototaxis switches from positive to negative at a critical intensity.
Okay.
I think there are, it smells like experiments that were done by people like Foster and others long ago when, when it was first discovered, you know, that you have this wonderful protein structure that gives you the directionality. But I don't know the answer off the top of my head.
Okay. Thank you.
Hi. Can you talk a little bit about senescence? You talk a lot about the old guys and the young guys, and I'm interested in what happens during senescence and how it affects the motility of these organisms.
I don't have anything deep to say about that. I mean, we know that the colony is changing its swimming properties and all of that, but I don't have a molecular understanding yet of where that comes from. So it sounds like you probably know more.
No.
It's really important because I mean, obviously the fact that it can't phototax when it's later means it must have not needed to. Like, so maybe once you've produced your progeny, you know, there is apoptosis eventually of the somatic cells, and so that this may be part of their path toward turning themselves off. But I don't really know.
So two quick questions. One is on your slide with current, you didn't mean current, you meant surface flux?
Surface flux.
Okay, sorry.
Integrated right. Flux.
Wait.
Integrated.
So that's exactly what confuses me, right? You want to increase the flux per cell, right? And the number of cells presumably is increasing as R squared.
Right, so I plot two things, just to be sure. Here, I'm integrating around the entire surface, okay? So that's what I'm plotting here. And then I divide this difference by R squared to get the per cell. On the next
and slide. That thing is still increasing. That's
that thing,
okay,
increases,
good.
But then
so,
yeah. So another.
I see, but and that fine. It's asymptoting to constant. Got it.
Yeah, that's the excess asymptote.
Very, very good. And another question is so completely different. You showed this planar cell polarity in orienting the photo sensors. Is it known where that comes from?
This is what we're going to try to figure out. There is. Clear evidence, I think, from electron micrographs post-inversion that there's a very highly organized pattern on the surface, and there's even a bit of chirality in the packing of the cells, which might be responsible for the tilt of the flagella. But the thing is that soon after inversion, you start excreting the CCM, the bridges break, and then, you know, they're on their own, but somehow it's maintained. Now, maybe that's just because they're very good at excreting the ECM homogeneously, in angle, and so they just move away from each other. But it's pretty neat how they do that. So we've started to track what the cells do as the ECM is added to get an idea of how accurate this is. But we're at early days, and I don't know.
But the statement is that that pattern appeared while there were bridges
exactly
between cells.
Yeah.
One of the interesting things about Volvox to me has always been that it's a limited kind of spurt of diversification, that it doesn't appear to be going anywhere.
Yeah, unfortunately.
And I'm just wondering if there's anything in the physics of what you've shown us today that kind of gives an upper size limit that beyond which this kind of form can't work.
Well, actually, I mean, it's your own work that gives the size limit. I mean, if you start asking about when gravitational effects matter, et cetera, you discover that you can't be much larger than gigas before you'll just sink. So if you know the typical kind of piconewton forces that the flagella exert, and you put in the numbers for density offset, et cetera, at least one thing will happen, which is that you can't swim up beyond a certain size. And I would take that as a severe limitation. And in fact, that's partly the kind of argument that's behind Bell and Cufapano's proposal about the germ-soma differentiation, that you see there's this flagellation constraint we've heard about, where when you go through cell division, you have to stop using your flagella. So if you stop doing that and you're built like Volvox, you sink. So how much sinking can you tolerate before, you know, the next generation comes out? And it's one way to rationalize the appearance of dedicated galley slaves on the outside and reproductive cells on the inside.
Where does that
thing
get on the spot?
Yeah, way off. Yep.
Excuse me. Asymmetry is important for many fundamental biological processes, and you show that asymmetry is important for taxis and so on here. So why are Volvox spherical? Would you design them this way? Is there a better shape to be? Is it a consequence of being made out of
visual enjoyment? I think.
But what about squashing them? Would they be better? Is this the best?
That's an interesting point. So you could ask questions about drag and how that depends on the body size. But of course, if everybody wants their place in the sun, you know, that's a pretty democratic way of doing it. But I don't really have a deep answer yet.
Is it,
I could conceive of cylindrical.
That's right. Has someone made a mutant that is, squashed, slipper-shaped?
Yeah, actually, you can do this. If you grow them on agar so that they bump into each other, then they're sort of like those square tomatoes you can grow buy in the store, you know, that have been grown so that they pack well. You end up with very weird shapes, and it's kind of imprinted in the ECM. So in principle, we could study aspects of that.
Hi. A question about the ontogeny of these early on. Now, it's clear that it's getting bigger, the benefit of the flagellum and of the advection is increasing because they're less diffusion, they get more advantage from swimming rather than diffusion as they get bigger. Now, when they are first born, so to speak, are they already big enough that they would profit more from advection than diffusion?
I would say probably yes. I mean, they're already on the scale of 150 microns, something like that, across. And so I think that the juveniles are Heckle number much larger than one.
So they're born already in this situation which you describe as one in which there's sort of socialism in the cell.
I would say yes. Based on this is a very simple model, but
right,
yes.
Now, is there a size at which, a still smaller size than that at which they're born, at which this advantage is no longer present?
Well, down on the scale
of the single
tens of microns,
this
advantage goes away.
And so is two cells already enough to gain the advantage?
Well, that's an interesting question. I think in some vague sense, yes, because even Chlamydomonas is sort of out of Heckle number order one. So,
yes.
So you put two of them together, I think there would be a modest increase in uptake. I mean, it's hard to justify that from such a highly simplified model, but if you're already at Heckle number order one, then any further change is going to make a kind of order one change.
So but is it possible then to find a system in which there would actually be a transition from individualism being diffusive individualism, if you will, being advantageous, and then switching to collective?
This Rick Trevisano's talk, engineering
engineers
thinking,
that
making sticking clammy selected. That to me.
That would do it, yeah.
Select on something other than sedimentation, maybe swimming speed or growth rate or whatever. So it could, I think that could open the door to seeing whether this is true or not. I'm not going to hang my hat on this. It's a hypothesis and it needs to be.
But in any case, that doesn't occur naturally in Volvox. They start out already big enough. Okay, thanks.
Yep.